So again, good evening, everyone. If you arrived a little late, just to say again, my name is Sally Armstrong. I teach a lot out at Spirit Rock, where I'm a co-guiding teacher and involved in a lot of meetings. It's mainly what that means. It sounds kind of elevated, but it just means I go to a lot of meetings, often with Philip Moffat, meeting with him tomorrow, actually. And I live right out there near Spirit Rock in Woodacre. And for those of you who know Spirit Rock a little bit, maybe you know we just opened our beautiful new community meditation center. So I really invite you to come out and enjoy that. And it's kind of like going from the prehistoric ages into the 21st century. If you remember our current community hall, it was a bunch of trailers literally duct taped together that were definitely more than showing their age and well overdue to be replaced. So we're very happy to be in our new building. And every time I'm invited to teach somewhere or, you know, teaching a retreat where we give teachings on a regular basis, there's always the question, what to talk about? And this is both a challenging question, you know, what would be useful, what needs to be said, what hasn't been said recently, whatever. But it always invites me into a space of wonder. And the wonder is at the brilliance of the Buddha's mind. He was a man who lived 2,600 years ago in rural India, didn't write anything down, didn't have Wikipedia on his phone to check, didn't have databases or anything to compile his teachings in. But he has left us with this breadth and depth of teachings and practices that's really quite remarkable and this amazing study of the human mind and heart. And so that's the challenges of everything that he said and pointed to. What will we talk about tonight? And, you know, some of his teachings are incredibly complex, detailed, dependent origination, a teaching, these 12 links that really describe how we go from ignorance to suffering over and over again. You know, the aggregates or the teachings on karma, the law of cause and effect. But I think what often gets overlooked in the brilliance of the Buddha, though perhaps it's less happening less these days, though, and we'll get into the whole discussion, but is mindfulness. It's just the power of mindfulness. And what I was going to was, well, secular mindfulness is really becoming very popular, but they don't talk about the Buddha and the fact that he invented it. They think Jon Kabat-Zinn made it up. The Buddha did, 2,600 years ago. And what he did was create a practice where instead of just calming and quieting the mind, and in his day, and still can happen, to deep states of absorption that were quite blissful, or doing practices that were more like supplications of to gods or to priests or to Brahmins with rituals and sacrifices, other kind of practices, this turning of the attention to our innermost and felt experience in this direct and profound way, that was really radical then, and I think it's still radical today. Because what that offers us is a way, an avenue of knowing ourselves in this intimate and deep way, knowing these minds and hearts, how they operate, what makes them work, what, you know, and the really very empirical, you know, seeing what you put in is what you get out. But a big part also of what mindfulness offers us is this choice point. If we truly connect with the present moment and know it, know what's happening, and we've done this again and again, and we know what we're doing, wisdom is present. And so this possibility of making wiser choices, because we often don't make wise choices. There's always a, you know, possibility of a wiser choice, but we're wiser than we were, right? There's this great possibility of, through this deep and profound knowing, actually responding in a way that's authentic and true, compassionate, and wise. And what he invites us also to do through this practice is deconstruct our experience in this sometimes very minute way, but, you know, we can do it all kinds of different ways. He gave us lots of doorways for this. Again, I'm just throwing these terms out. Some of you may know them, others not, but there's so many lists and practices. The five aggregates, the places where we cling. mentioned dependent origination, all of the different mental factors that he spoke about that we can know, the ones that are wholesome and beneficial and the ones that are unskillful and leads to suffering, that we can know these directly. Practices that we teach that are more modern adaptations or ways to invite us into practice, like rain, where we recognize our experience, accept or allow it to be as it is, we get interested in it, and then we understand that it's nature, it's natural. We don't get stuck or caught in that experience. So all these different ways we kind of deconstruct experience so we can understand what's happening, and from that understanding grow our own wisdom. So we take the wisdom of the Buddha and all of our other teachers and guides, but the most important thing is developing our own wisdom and understanding through these practices. Because it's only when we begin to see clearly what's happening, when something is brought into the field of awareness, that we can begin to transform it. If we're just flailing blindly in reactivity, that's what we're going to cultivate, right? More blindness and more reactivity. But if we actually start to penetrate into our experience, we can start to, as I keep saying, act more wisely and begin to work with these tendencies of mind, which most of all of us have actually, of greed, aversion, and delusion, holding on to things that we like, pushing away what we don't like, or acting and being in a state of confusion or denial or ignorance. So we want to bring these experiences into the light of awareness, all of our experience, so we can learn from it, learn how to respond more wisely. And this is true, particularly, but like all of our experience, of intention. And that's what I want to talk about tonight, this factor, this mental factor of intention. In Buddhist psychology or understanding, intention is considered a universal mental factor, which means it's operating all the time. We are always intending. If we don't recognize that, we're cultivating and fostering intentions that are shaped by our past habits and conditioning. And as I said, these are often really shaped by these forces, greed, aversion, delusion, and our own particular manifestations of those from our family origin, from our schooling, from our experiences, everything that shaped us. Intention gets formed out of that. So bringing this factor into mind is a powerful way of beginning this transformation and reshaping of the mind. And what I want to talk about tonight is the three different kinds or levels of intention that are operating for all of us and how we can bring them into more mindfulness and clarity so, again, we can work with them more skillfully. And all of these three different levels are important, and in some way you could say they're all operating all the time, but really it's intention, and as a translation of Pali word cetana, C-E-T-A-N-A, that's the most kind of foundational, that's the one that's the universal mental factor that's happening all the time. But we need all three levels to do anything, really, to live a life. But certainly if we want to shape our life and practice the path that the Buddha invites us to walk on, the Noble Eightfold Path, these three mental factors or intention, kinds of intention, are essential. So the first one is cetana, this moment-to-moment operating in the mind, you know, even this snapping of the fingers that I keep doing for some reason to try and imply, you know, this momentariness of the intention. I have to have an intention to do that. Every gesture has an intention behind it. So these large and small actions are out of cetana. Then the next level we call adhitana. And that sometimes gets translated as determination or resolution, motivation. It's a kind of bigger level intention. One of the challenges in English is we tend to be a little sloppy, and this word intention gets used from the most micro kind of movement to, you know, our intention for our life's purpose. And so I might be sloppy in that way tonight and use words in that way. The Buddha was a bit little more precise. Chaitanya, the moment to moment, Adhidhana, more this resolution, and then wise intention, which is a path factor, Sankappa, or Sama Sankappa, is an expression of wisdom. It is what develops out of our mindfulness practice to keep us walking on the path. And these, again, if you know anything about Buddhism, you will know the Buddha loved lists. And so here's a list of lists, and within each list there's another list that's a subset. So in Sankappa there are three factors or three wise intentions, an intention towards renunciation, to non-harming, and non-ill will. And I'll talk about all of these tonight. So I really see these as kind of like a triangle. And, you know, a triangle is one of the most stable shapes, I guess. But it's kind of stretchy, you know, it's not just a regular, you know, sometimes one will be more predominant, sometimes we're really very clear about some aspect of the intention and we're working on that, but they're all necessary. And unless we have some clarity about all three, we're not going to progress on the path. And, you know, you may not have thought in this way and you're like, well, I've come along some way. But it's because you've done this. We perhaps haven't done it quite as consciously as you might have done. But they're essential for us on the path of practice, or, as I said, really to do anything. So I'll start with this foundation factor, chaitanya. It's considered a mental factor, so it's something that happens in the mind. But it's this kind of urge to do, and it's also felt on an energetic basis. You know, the mind precedes the body movement, but what, because the mind movement is so fleeting, we often only notice the gesture, but the mind impetus was there before us. And it's what got us all here tonight. You know, you had the thought, we're in Sangha, looked at your watch, got in your car, pressed the pedal, here you are, you know, and a sequence of intentions. If you just got in your car and didn't, you know, turn it on, press the pedal, you'd still be sitting in your driveway, right? So it just, everything proceeds out of this continuity of intention. And in some way, it got us on the path of practice. You know, something sparked in us about the possibility of mindfulness, about these teachings, about the deepening that can happen. And we began. But the thing about intention, it's, as I keep saying, has to be renewed all the time. You can't, you're not here tonight because of the intention you had to come last week. It has to be renewed all the time. I heard my friend Carol Wilson, another Dhamma teacher, colleague, talk about this intention, and she likened it to, it's Frodo, isn't it, in Lord of the Rings, Frodo? Where, you know, he had this first, you know, he's like, take this ring to somewhere, I forget where it was. It was like, oh, that seems terrible, but I guess I can do that. But then what happens? You know, he gets chased and attacked and pushed and pulled. And at each time, it's like, this is impossible. I can't keep doing this. But what was the choice? He had to keep going. So it's not like we coast on our first or initial intention. We have to keep renewing it, and it often gets harder. In ways, the path of practice does get easier as we get more faith and more understanding. But at the same time, it gets harder, too, as we realize, as one beautiful poet says, the depth and breadth of the cloth of what we're working with. But you've also probably felt, again, if you're here and committed, that you can't stop. You know, that something makes sense and keeps you moving. And so we keep re-nourishing, refreshing this kind of intention. Now, chaitanya is intention, volitional action, action that's done with a mental factor preceding it, is the heart of karma. And, you know, the Buddha gave long and deep teachings on karma, but the basic definition of karma is volitional action done with intent. So just a very simple teaching, you know, if you're out walking on a path and you don't see an ant or an insect and you step on it, said not to have karma because it wasn't an intentional act. The Buddha's teaching about karma was really that it rests on the intention. Now, as we get more sophisticated, we can see, and I could give more of a teaching on this, but I won't tonight, that we our actions, especially of speech, can have impact that wasn't our intention. We can hurt or harm others through our words, through our actions, of course. And especially as we move into more multicultural communities or people from different gender orientation, sexual orientation, just through not knowing, we can sometimes cause harm. This teaching isn't about taking refuge in, oh, I didn't mean that. You know, if you're upset, it wasn't my intention. This is a whole cycle then, because then there's the intention behind how do we respond to the harm when someone lets us know that something was harmful. So again, there's complexity in this that we have to practice with, but we don't want to, even though it is so much about intention, we also have to register impact and then how we respond to that impact and the intention that arises out of that. But we really have to see that intention shapes everything that we do. As I said, we're here tonight because of intention. Intention, it happens in a mind moment, but as we, there's a thread that gets created that can last over a lifetime of practice or of living. And the important thing in our practice is to recognize that it's happening all the time. We're always acting out of intention, whether we're aware of it or not. And so we need to really be heedful of that, because intention shapes us and our actions and lives get shaped in return by those intentions. So the more we can bring them into consciousness, the more we can be in alignment with our true values. Sylvia Boorstein said, before she ever does anything, she always asks, to what end? You know, as I make this decision, this movement, what am I moving towards? What is the result that I would like to happen? And we all know that unless we have intention, things don't happen. How many of you have wished you could learn Italian? I know I have. It's like, oh, it's such a beautiful language. I'd love to spend time in Italy. It hasn't happened because I haven't followed through. You know, I do the little, you know, get the tapes or the CD, sit at my computer, and after a few days, it doesn't happen. So I still don't speak Italian. It's understandable. Anything, exercise, you know, whatever healthy idea we have, you see how it needs this continuity of renewing the intention. It does. We can't coast. We can't coast. And of course, you know, it's not just about, oh, if I have the intention, then it will happen. We need to recognize the complexity of a life and all the different conditions and causes that we come into contact with. But unless we keep shaping the intention, it definitely won't happen. We have to shape and clarify the intention and then navigate what life presents us. And to say, you know, after teaching many retreats, the most common question really always is at the end of the retreat is, how do I have a daily practice? I know it would be good for me. It's like, you know, it's like medicine or multivitamins. I know they'd be good for me, but how do I do this on a daily basis? And my answer is always some variation of the same. It won't happen because you think it should, or if you were a good Buddhist, you would, or you think you'd be happier, or any kind of wish fulfillment thinking. It will only happen when you clarify the intention for yourself that that's really a value. And look and see what are the supports you need and how do you integrate that into a realistic assessment of your life and your capabilities or time or whatever it is. Then maybe it will happen, but it doesn't happen through wishful thinking. So we have to create the intention and really see this vision of what that might look like, this aspiration, and then let the movement, the intention, the action come out of that. And I know for me, when I first encountered Buddhism meditation, it's getting so many years ago, it's almost embarrassing. It was in the early 80s, actually in India, did my first retreat with Goenkaji, S.N. Goenka. And I remember, I was probably clueless. I probably didn't sit still for a moment. I would have been so fidgety. It was so uncomfortable. But something touched me really deeply. And I couldn't express what it was, I'm sure, but some truth, some path was offered. And I still remember the I guess you could say it was insight, but it was more like faith. And the phrase was something like, you mean I don't have to go around causing suffering all the time to myself and to others, that my relationships can actually be skillful or kind? That was like a revelation to me. I thought we just all stumbled around in the dark and you got on with some people and you didn't get on with others. But to see you could actually cultivate these qualities of kindness and listening and wisdom, it was a revelation for me. And so from that time on, I just made it my life's intention to be around the Dhamma, to be on Dhamma retreats, to do Dhamma service, to live in Dhamma communities, and all these other options. I was just traveling with a backpack. I could do anything with as much money as I had. I was traveling very cheaply, but you know, it felt like I could go anywhere, do anything. And I kept, you know, saying no to my friends who wanted to do this, travel to Yugoslavia or Czechoslovakia or Ireland. I said, no, I want to go be with Dhamma people. And it shaped my life. I ended up managing a retreat center in England. I met my future husband there. We ended up starting a meditation community together in England. Ended up, after 5 years, coming here to California. I started volunteering at what was then IMW. How many people remember IMW? Insight Meditation West. That was as exotic as we were called, because there was, you know, IMS on the East Coast. We were IMW. Became Spirit Rock. So I ended up being executive director there for a while. And my whole life really has developed out of that initial intention. How do I stay close and connected and keeping that alive? You know, what would help me align my life with the Dhamma, with Dhamma people, Dhamma places, Dhamma values? So for all of us, you know, it's just what shapes us. But we need to keep refreshing it, keeping connected with that. So the next level or type of intention is adhitana. This is a Pali word. It's again usually translated as resolves or determination. It's one of the paramis. It's one of these 10 perfections that we develop on our path of practice. Are the ones, you know, metta, dana, generosity, patience, equanimity, renunciation. So it's considered one of these beautiful qualities of the heart. It's kind of determination. But it's not, I'm kind of clenching my fist, I was just going to say, it's not this fierce, clenched kind of determination. It's more a steadiness. It's like leaning into, like whether the intention is created, the direction we want to go, and adhitana is the endurance that enables us to keep going. And I don't, again, if you've done metta practice, loving kindness practice, and have used phrases, may I be happy, may we be peaceful, may we be healthy, they're considered adhitanas. They're resolves. And so again, you can feel that as you lean into, oh man, you know, we don't say, I will, I should, I must. There's this invitation, may I, but that's an adhitana. That's the kind of resolution that we're talking about. And it's, you know, what we see in any life, but especially a spiritual life, there'll be obstacles and hindrances and challenges, right? I mean, that's almost needed for us to purify on the path, so I was just going to say we can welcome them. That's a practice in itself, but that's where we learn, right, from the challenges, the difficulties. It's the adhitana. It's the determination that keeps us going, that keeps us orienting to practice and going against the stream, you know, the Buddha talked about so often. This culture does not support the kind of awakening that we do on this path. So we need this kind of determination to go through the difficult times, to be with the challenges, to just keep orienting to letting go and freedom, what this path actually offers. And so whether it's just in your daily life, keeping up a meditation practice, certainly being on retreat, if you've been on a residential retreat, you'll know that kind of steadiness that it needs day after day, hour after hour, when you just want to run and scream or, you know, do anything but do another sitting and another walking. And then something lets go, something releases, and we just keep going. So powerful. There's a beautiful set of teachings in the canon, in the it's called the canon, the Pali canon, the Buddha's teachings, there are some texts that aren't just from the Buddha. So there's a collection called the Theragata. These are the verses of the elder monks. There's also equivalent, the Therigata, the verses of the elder nuns. They're often kind of enlightenment poems, or they're very evocative of often challenges in practice, but the mind releasing. So this is one relevant to what I'm talking about now. It's too hot, it's too cold, too hot, too late in the evening. People who say this, shirking their work, the moment passes them by. Whoever regards cold and heat as no more than grass, doing their duties won't fall away from ease. With my chest, I push through wild grasses, spear grass, ribbon grass, rushes, cultivating a secluded heart. Cultivating a secluded heart. So just that sense, you know, the monks and nuns were always out in nature, so nature imagery was predominant for them. But this sense of the outer conditions not impacting, this willingness to keep going, this willingness to keep practicing, and then cultivating a secluded heart, basically a quiet heart. A still heart, even as we're in relationship, that the heart has this sense of connected stillness. So this is the quality that keeps us moving, endurance, determination. In the text, the Majjhima Nikaya Sutta 140, the Buddha said there are these four great resolves: the resolve for wisdom, the resolve for truth, the resolve for generosity, and the resolve for peace. One should not neglect wisdom. One should preserve truth. One should cultivate generosity, and one should train in peace. So really very central, this having an intention, these four beautiful qualities, and continuing in their development. Say a lot more about Aditana, but I want to move on to the last kind of intention, which is really the biggest level of these intentions, Sammasankappa, wise intention. As I said, it's one of the path factors, so there's the four noble truths, truth of suffering, cause of suffering being craving, possibility for the end of suffering, and the path leading to the end of suffering is the Noble Eightfold Path. And the first path factor is wise understanding or wise view, which leads to wise intention. As we deepen in wisdom, in understanding, as we purify the mind and heart, what becomes the natural expression is this wise intention or wise motivation, Sammasankappa. And this word "sama" precedes all of the path factors, and we often translate it as wise, but it can also mean right, and not as in right or wrong, but in right as in onward leading, what cultivates the path. So sama sankappa. And really it's about Dhamma values that get naturally cultivated on the path, but also that we need to keep intentionally cultivating the intention towards renunciation or letting go, to non-ill will, in its positive form becomes goodwill or metta, and the intention towards harmlessness or non-harming, which in its positive manifestation becomes compassion. So even, and this is a, you'll often find in the Pali language, this is a language the texts were written down in, that these expressions of the awakened heart are expressed in the negative, non-harming, non-ill will. And for us in the English, that can seem a little kind of, you know, want something a little more expressive, a little more expansive. But the brilliance of that is there's always the possibility for us of restraint. We might not be able to immediately have compassion if we're struggling with something, but that we can actually not harm. Start with that basic non-harming or non non-ill will. We mightn't be feeling metta, but we can not wish ill. Can we start there? And from there, anything is possible. So there's a real skillfulness in this simplicity of the framing to renunciation, non-ill will, and harmlessness. And we can build to the positive. So to speak just a little bit about all three. The first being renunciation. Not a sexy word in this culture. You don't see, you know, USA Today articles on the benefits of renunciation. You know, the capitalist society is built on getting more. The stock market, the whole economics really are built on, if you're not expanding, you're dying, basically. So it's the opposite of that. But in our practice, this isn't seen as a penance. It's not like getting rid of, you know, if you have anything that's attachment, greed, you should let go of everything. It really is seen as a source for joy and well-being. Basically, it's about simplicity and being content with what one has rather than always needing more. And so there's a lot of reflection that can happen in this area. What really, again, is our intention for our well-being, and what would that look like? What do we truly need? Not, you know, making lists of everything we need to get rid of, because it's beyond that. It's really an internal sense of well-being and simplicity, not looking outward. A while ago, I read in Parade magazine, which we don't get anymore in the Sunday paper. I mean, it was my one source for celebrity gossip, so I don't have much anymore. But Parade magazine, I don't know what happened to it. But it often had very uplifting articles, right? And so I saw one that was entitled, Why We Gave Away Our Home. And it was a story of a very traditional middle-class family, probably in the Midwest somewhere. I don't remember the details now. And they'd become quite successful, had some money, so they built their dream house where everyone had their room, their own separate room. You know, there's probably a, what do you call it these days, entertainment room and a this room and a that room, a huge house. And what happened in that huge house is they lost touch with each other. Mm-hmm. They never saw each other. They just, that are, you know, on their screens or in their own rooms. And they really started to see the impact of that in their lives together. And one day the daughter read something about the inequality in the world, and especially in this culture, and got really upset about that, with the disparities. And so the mother said to her, so if you're really serious about that, what are you willing to sacrifice? What will you give up? Your room? This house? And Hannah, her name, said yes to both. And so the whole family came together and talked it over, and they decided to sell their house and move to one half its size and price and donate the difference to charity. And so they took a year to decide what to do with the money, what charity to give. And in that consultation with each other became closer and more connected than they ever had been. And in the giving of the money, discovered such joy and happiness and well-being. They gave to the Hunger Project, a U.S.-based nonprofit that works with villages in Africa, Asia, and South America, helps them move from poverty to self-reliance. And the family said, the best move we ever made. So just that, you know, it's not that we have to go live out on the streets or in a cave, but really, what do we need and how can we share our blessings with others? I love this teaching from Bhikkhu Bodhi. Real renunciation is not a matter of compelling ourselves to give up things still inwardly cherished, but of changing our perspective on them so they no longer bind us. That's really it. It's not about the things. It's about our relationship, our attitude, and are we dependent on them, holding on to them for our happiness, and seeing it's not a reliable source, not a reliable source for happiness. The next of the intentions is that of non-ill will. As I said, this can be the foundation. Can we restrain ourselves from acting out of ill will? Hopefully often find that we can. Then we can develop goodwill, metta, loving kindness. again, refer her to Carol Wilson. I often teach with her, and she's great for these one-liners. I wrote this down. She can't even remember she said it, but she said, "Fake meta is better than real aversion anytime." And it's true, right? You know, even if you're smiling and perhaps not the meta isn't flowing, but you're not acting out of ill will. You're not acting out of aversion. That's a step in the right direction. Because we can't force metta. There's no on switch. We can't make that happen. But as we, through mindfulness, stay in touch with our feelings and our relationships and our connections, we can start to shift that fundamental way we relate. And the most important shift to make, the most important place to shift that feeling sometimes of ill will, aversion, is towards ourselves. Because most of us are meaner and more critical to ourselves than we are to anyone. Perhaps our dearly beloved gets it next on the list, but most of us, it's our internal ill will that really shapes the mind and the heart in a way that doesn't allow us to fully develop in metta. Because we're coming from this place of diminishment, of lack of self-acceptance. So really important, if we're going to walk this path and develop the intention towards non-ill will, non-aversion, it begins here, right? It begins right here in this heart. So many of us, myself included, and so many that I talk to, this pain of self-judgment, lack of self-acceptance, it's huge. It's a deep wound in our culture. And so doing what, if that's a tendency of mind for you, if you find the mind goes to the critical thinking, goes to the not good enough, goes to the, you know, everyone else but not me, better than, worse than, this judging, fixing and comparing that I know Philip talks a lot about, start to work with this. It's essential. It's essential. We cannot truly deepen on the path until we've begun this work. We don't have to wait till we've finished it to walk on the path, but we certainly need to begin it. We need to start reorienting in this way. So there's many great resources out there. There's books and workshops. A couple that I've really liked, Byron Brown, Soul Without Shame, Tara Brach, Radical Acceptance. Both have a spiritual, meditative approach to this work. We need to look in this direction so we can actually begin the healing and begin it right here at home in the heart. And so looking at what we need to do in this area, Byron Brown in that book says, "The only real alternative to self-judgment is knowing the truth about who you are. If you have a deep belief that you are worthless, you must discover where that belief came from and why you believe it to be true. Once you know deep inside you with a direct and felt sense that you have inherent value and are fully acceptable to yourself, then you will free yourself from the need for positive judgment and approval from others and from your own judge." So just a few words to say about this, but so essential. To begin here at home, the healing, the transformation begins through this practice of kindness and love. And metta is a profound practice to begin this work. And we begin it with metta for ourselves. May I be safe and protected from harm. May I be well and happy, peaceful. May I live with joy and ease. So this is where we begin. And then the last of the wise intentions, this big picture of Dharma values to align with, is harmlessness, is not causing harm. The basis of that is sila or ethical conduct. I love the Pali term ahimsa, means literally non-harming. And when we act in this way, when we follow in the ethical conduct in Buddhist teachings, is based on the precepts, the five precepts of not killing living beings, not stealing, not taking what hasn't been given, not harming ourselves or others through sexual activity, practicing wise speech, not indulging in harmful speech, and not clouding the mind and heart through drugs or alcohol. When we act in this way with integrity, It's a gift, it's a boon, and the gift we give other people or other beings is the gift of fearlessness. They don't have to fear us. They know we're not going to harm them, even the smallest creature, an ant or a mosquito. We can know that of us. And the gift we give ourselves is freedom from remorse. And that's a not insignificant gift. If you've ever sat down in meditation, in extended meditation, you will know the thoughts, the memories that come up of past actions and hurts and how they just ripple through our mind and heart. And actually making a commitment to living a life of non-harming as best we can. Again, these are not commandments, they're training precepts. So we orient to them, we use them as landmarks, as guideposts, as signals, but we don't get rigid or dogmatic about them. So as best we can, we orient. And then the positive expression of that non-harming is compassion, is letting the heart respond to suffering, inner and outer, with compassion. Basic human kindness, as the Dalai Lama says over and over again. Albert Einstein seemed to be such a wise, brilliant person, but also a wise person. They're two different things. He said, "The ideals which have lighted my way and time after time given me new courage to face life cheerfully have been kindness, beauty, and truth." Just this basic human kindness, so essential. But the proximate cause for compassion, for this response of the heart, is suffering and our willingness to be touched by suffering, not to push it away at arm's length, to let it in. And this is again where our practice of connection and mindfulness, awareness of the impact, awareness of the feeling, just like we did at the end of our meditation, can we let it in as much as we can? And there's so much suffering in the world today. So much cruelty and injustice and racism and prejudice and inequality. We can feel overwhelmed, so that's where the equanimity is so important. That the mind has to learn how to stay in balance as it stays open. But it begins with feeling, with the mindfulness of this is what I'm feeling now. So the three kinds of wise intention, renunciation, non-ill will, non-harming. This is a Sama Sankappa. As I said at the beginning, to really develop on the path, we need to kind of keep track of these three levels or types of intention. They're always shaping us, but we can shape them. So this iterative process needs to keep going. So Chaitanya, the moment-to-moment, is the engine. No, he says the moment-to-moment. Aditana is the endurance or the engine that keeps it going. We keep shaping the resolve, the moment-to-moment, but then it's kind of the rudder that steers us. And then Sama Sankappa is the big picture. What are we actually aligning to? What are we developing? What do we orient around as we deepen on the path of practice? And it's kind of like, you know, a Rube Goldberg machine. You see that? I've seen they put them up on the web where, you know, it goes all over the room. If any one thing stops, the ball stops rolling, right? All has to work. And of course, they only show the videos of when it all works and the dominoes all fall and the traps open. But practice is like that, right? We have to kind of keep our eye on all of these different aspects. We can't just, you know, grab a hold of something out of rigidity and dogma and say, this is where I'm going. And it all stems out of mindfulness. It all stems out of knowing what's happening. I mentioned secular mindfulness earlier, and you know, I'm sure you're aware, it's just becoming more and more popular in education, in the healthcare system, in prisons, and in the tech world. It's big in the tech world. Google has, you know, their search engines, you know, which searches the world, the internet, and they have a whole meditation program called Search Inside. You know, it's up there, Search Inside something.
Yourself.
Search Inside Yourself. And so they're developing meditation practices because they see it as so helpful. Facebook, Dustin Moskowitz, who helped start Facebook, is really into meditation, and he said, mindfulness has helped me succeed in almost every dimension of my life. By stopping regularly to look inward and become aware of my mental state, I stay connected to the source of my actions and thoughts and can guide them with considerably more intention. We're just seeing this relationship. And Sharon Salzberg says, by making the effort to notice our intentions with honesty and clarity, we gain a great deal of freedom. If we take the time to pay quiet attention, perhaps through meditation or contemplation, we may develop a completely different understanding of why we do the things we do and a new perspective on how to trust that we've done the best we can. When we develop the habit of noticing our intentions, we have a much better compass with which to navigate our lives. We learn to cast a glance at our motivations before we speak or act, which frees us to live the life we want. She always puts it so beautifully. All out of mindfulness. And what develops and deepens mindfulness? What conditions mindfulness? More moments of mindfulness and noticing that you're mindful. And that's an iterative process that we deepen in. So we kind of, you know, again, this moving in and out of the very intimate, the immediate, so personal, into this bigger picture. And practice in life is just to flow in and out and between those. As Padmasambhava, the Indian saint, said, my view, and he means his understanding, his wisdom, my view is as vast as the sky, but my actions and respect for the laws of karma, basically intention, are as fine as a grain of sampa, of barley flour. And I always like that both, we have to have this big picture of practice and how our life is developing and unfolding, but know that it comes out of this moment's action, this moment's mindfulness, this moment's intention. So we have a few moments now before I know we have some closing words and rituals, but have you paid attention in this way? Which of these three kinds of mindfulness is clearest for you? The moment-to-moment one we often talk about in meditation, but it's so easy to lose track of because it's so sudden, you know, it happens and we're already acting before we're aware of it. The adhitana is more of a sense of our aspirations for ourselves, and then these Dharma values. So anyone like to share which of these three or any of these three that you've brought attention to in your practice and what has been the result, whether it's on intensive practice, on retreat, or in your life, meditation practice? Yes, Mary.
So my question would be actually,
thank you.
I might go for a period of time and have my intention is to practice kindness, and then ask myself, what does the kindness look like? And that would be kind of like the overview. And so, which one would that be? If that was, you know, and I don't even know which one of the three that you're talking about, if that would fit that would fit into.
Well, it's just asking the question. I wouldn't even, you know, there's an intention behind asking the question, but intention really is about action. Mm-hmm. So when you ask the question, what would kindness look like? Uh-huh. Is that the question? Mm-hmm. It's the answer that would shape the intention. We one of the intentions, and perhaps it's the intention samasankapa, mm-hmm. towards metta, towards goodwill.
So when I practice that, what I would do even constantly is I want to be kind, so I'm constantly asking myself what would be kind. Because I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like you think, you know, you think you're being kind when you do something, and it's like, really? Let's look, you know, especially as a parent.
Yes.
You know, sometimes being kind is not doing the nice thing.
Yes, definitely.
So, so for me, it's a constant reframing of what that's going to be, and constantly having to ask myself, and in my morning sit saying, this is what I want, what does kindness look like, what would it look like for myself, and then just kind of trying to remember during the course of the day,
yeah,
before I say something or do something,
yeah,
what would kindness look like?
Lovely. Yeah, so that as it's really shaping your actions, I'd put that in the Samasankappa, because you're really letting yourself be guided by the intention towards kindness, towards goodwill, and shaping that. And that's, you know, as the Buddha said, that's a path, that first two path factors, right view, understanding, and then this is what shapes all of the other path factors. So that's beautiful. Yeah, thank you. Yeah?
Well, for me, you know, intention has been an important, closer shift.
I think it has to be like this, yes.
Important issue. Yes. But in recent times, in reading Joseph Goldstein's book on mindfulness, we're at the place of the, what is it called? I can't think, but, you know, I realized intention arises and passes away.
Yes.
Just like all the other aspects of life. And so it's not always present. I mean, it's present, but I might not be aware.
Exactly.
But the intention changes from moment to moment. I could walk by an ice cream store, and my intention was to go to the store and buy a bottle of milk, but all of a sudden my intention is to get a chocolate ice cream cone, and it just, you know, from causes and conditions, intention goes away. But it was very useful for you to highlight the different kinds of intention. Those are sort of mundane intentions, not wise intentions. So that where I'm at in the practice is trying to see, just notice when intention comes up.
And that's exactly it. That's what I was trying to point to, because your example is a great one. You had the intention, that's an aditana, a resolve, go get some milk, but walking by the ice cream store, an unconscious intention or subconscious intention redirected the energy. And the mindfulness is, can we notice that redirecting or that intention shaping us before we actually are in the store with the money in our hand or the ice cream cone in our hand? That's the practice. And it only, I talk about post-mortem mindfulness. It's like, oh, what happened there? We can learn from, you know, what was something, you know, the eye saw, the tongue, the taste buds salivated. There were a lot of signals that got you, the feet moved, right? A lot of things happened that got you in there. It didn't, you know, the aliens didn't come in and take over your body and direct you into the store. So it's just being willing to, you know, once you're there with your eye, how did I get here? And really track. Could I have noticed? What would have been interesting or helpful to notice in that sequence that redirected me from my initial intention? Because this is what's happening all the time. We have one intention in this direction and, you know, we end up over there. And as our famous Yogi Berra said, if you don't know where you're going, you might end up somewhere else.
I don't know if this is something you can address, but I'm really struck by what happened in Orlando. And I'm sorry.
Yes.
I guess I'd like, what does the Buddha teach with that? So, you know, my intention is loving kindness and compassion, and I know that this, but all that's pretty hard right now.
Yes. No, and it's not to deny how hard it is and how infuriating it is or frustrating it is. But you said, when you said, what does the Buddha say? I said what he said. Hatred never ceases by hatred. And we have to be with what we're feeling, not deny the grief and the rage and the fear and the anger and the sadness, because they're all there. And these are the conditions we're living in. Guns are available to virtually anyone. Hatred is everywhere. And if people put those two together, this is what happens. And it's not, you know, I'm not trying to diminish one iota, but this is where this practice also helps, is equanimity says, this is not random. You know, random act of violence. It's not random. It's not random. You know, there was intention, such clear intention in this and in all of these acts of violence that have been perpetrated over these many years, both by this kind of shooting, but by the police. By the police, too. So, you know, we have to hold both. The heart opening, connecting, sympathy, compassion, empathy, and the equanimity that allows us to keep doing that and not curling up in a ball and going, this is too crazy, how can I be in this society? But here we are, and you know, as I was even giving this meditation, we're in this light-filled room in Marin, you know, with the bay sparkling outside. Blessed. And people are dying right now. You know? And we have these peak experiences that get noticed. And I loved, I hated it, but after, I forget which one, isn't it terrible that we can't remember which one, where the Huffington Post just started putting up all of the mass shootings, four or more people, day after day, lists of them. They had to stop doing it after a while because it was just endless. And we numb out, you know, it's not our experience. So how do we hold it? What were the Buddha's words? Hatred never ceases by hatred. And here we are.